Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Are you interested in learning about how you can determine the best chance of effectiveness for when to intervene during a session? In my upcoming courses in March, I consider the implications of the studies I'm about to present in this episode and more, and then I share some strategies for observing eye contact between you and your patient during session in order to determine when is the best time to deliver interventions for your patient's success. If you'd like to learn more about this, you can find information and links on connectiontherapypodcast.com. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. It is clear there are links between someone's physical health and their mental health. It is difficult to tell which leads which, a bit of a chicken and the egg problem, if you will, in that it is not clear the cause and effect of this relationship, only that there is a correlation. Then, what does this mean to us as mental health clinicians? What do we do with this awareness? For me, the next steps are not readily identifiable, but one thing is clear, and that is I want to learn more about how to recognize the ways these relationships reveal themselves in my therapy office. There are many things to learn, even just with eye contact and eye movements. There is a tremendous amount of information. In this episode, I'm going to discuss some more details about how features of the eye reveal certain internal reactions and how we can recognize them in our therapy offices. Lately, I've been trying to pull things from different fields in order to understand more about this phenomena. And in this episode, I'm going to share three things to support you in doing the same. The first insight here comes from experts in the field of nonverbal communication, and it's from a book by that name, and the authors are Judy Burgoon, Valerie Manusoff, and Laura Guerrero. The authors note, and I quote, "Many eye behaviors convey meaning in interpersonal settings. Engaging in eye contact with someone, for instance, might communicate interest, attraction, or anger, whereas failing to make eye contact may denote submissiveness, respect, or shame." But then they highlight that there is one eye signal that is universal and a more direct physical reaction, and that is the dilation of the pupils. This is the dark circle in the middle of the eye that changes a lot of times with different amounts of light. So when you walk outside and it's bright, your pupils constrict. And when it's dark and you need to see, they expand so that you can see the room better. What also happens, as they explain, is that pupil dilation is affected by attraction. So when people look at someone they find attractive, their pupils open up wider than normal. And the thinking is this happens because the nervous system becomes aroused when people look at someone attractive. And this is also why they note that you can sometimes feel your heart rate go up in the presence of an attractive person. So while this realization may be awkward, to be sure, I think it is a universal experience. And it's one more reminder of how what's happening internally for us is being displayed externally. And in this case, without our ability to control it. In other words, you can't physically control the size of your pupils. They also note that pupils dilate in other situations as well. For example, when we are processing complex auditory information, putting mental effort into a task, or exploring something new, our pupil size increases. And these are quotes from their book that I will list on connectiontherapypodcast.com, so you can reference it if you would like. The authors also explain some research that suggests people are found to be more attractive when their pupils are dilated. And they surmise that this might be related to many romantic encounters and dating rituals in which, you know, there are dinners over candlelight and things, because that would increase the possibility of the dilation of pupils, and since it's a darker environment. Okay, so let's see what the next topic involves and how we can put some of this information together. The next author I'd like to review is Paul Ekman, and this time out of his book, Emotions Revealed. He's the author and researcher who developed the facial action coding system, which I mentioned in episode number 9. And a lot of his research and theories are encapsulated in this book. And in it, he highlights some really original research in this area by French neurologist named Duchesne de Boulogne. And the original research dates back to 1862. And what happens from this research is we now have the phrase the Duchesne smile, because what he identified is that there are muscles around the eye that only activate in a genuine, or what he called frank joy expression. And you can have a disingenuous or like a kind of forced smile where the rest of the facial features look like a smile, but it's these two muscles, one in particular that for most people is involuntarily activated. The combination of those is what suggests someone is genuinely smiling. And Ekman goes on to review one of those two muscles is called the orbicularis oculi. And Duchesne originally suggested that no one could voluntarily move that muscle, but Ekman and team have later found that about 10% of people can. But on the whole, most people cannot voluntarily make this muscle activate around the eye. And when it does, it's suggested that this expression on the face is coming from internal to the person because they're experiencing joy, and that's why the muscle activates. And what's interesting is Ekman has a lot of photos in his book, and he has other videos that really help bring this to life, because when you look at the photos side by side where these muscles are not activated, there is something that is a bit off-putting about the person who's smiling. There's a way in which I think we can sense these things whether we're conscious of it or not, which is why I'm reviewing them here, is to try to increase our awareness of what it is that we are seeing in our therapy offices and in humans in general, just to help us start to get really skilled at being able to discern our own internal reactions to what we see on the expressions of others and how to tie those to mental health support. And the next study is done by authors Charlotte Vanon Witvliet, Ross Noel, Nova Hinman, and Paul DeYoung. It was completed in 2010 and published in the Journal of Positive Psychology. and its title is Compassion-Focused Reappraisal, Benefit-Focused Reappraisal, and Rumination After an Interpersonal Offense, Emotional Regulation Implications for Subjective Emotion, Linguistic Responses, and Physiology. So they took 71 adults and asked them about an interpersonal offense that they experienced, and they compared three different responses to that. One was rumination, so the person kind of ruminating their thoughts about what happened, and then two reappraisal strategies. The reappraisal strategies are benefit focused, you know, sort of that silver lining, like, okay, something bad happened, and did anything kind of good come from this? And compassion focused, which was to emphasize the offender's humanity and try to determine if there were, you know, common human experiences between the offender and the person, or maybe all humans. And they asked them to do these, you know, kind of strategies in response to thinking about the event all in the span of 90 minutes. And during that, they had them do some typing exercises, you know, to explain their thoughts and feelings. And they also did some physiological calculations of what happened after each of these phases of the experiment. And they looked at heart rate variability and eye movements as part of their physiological indicators. And the way I found this study is I went searching for any research on that eye muscle, that orbicularis oculi, and this study, it looks specifically at it. And the study has many results since it has so many different ways it was looking at this phenomena. But the compassion-focused technique, they state, quote, had unique effects on the face and heart, end quote. And essentially, the results for the orbicularis oculi and the beat-to-beat intervals for the heart went in the direction that is, quote, consistent with reductions in effective arousal, end quote. And so essentially, they're suggesting that both the reappraisal strategies, the benefit one, and the compassion-focused one had physiological and other indicators that this one was increasing positive affect or positive emotions and reducing the effective arousal associated with negative emotions. And I just find it fascinating that the physiological indicators are so in line with what the people are reporting. We don't always see that, actually. Sometimes the way someone thinks or feels kind of leads or is behind their physiological indications. But in this case, this research is showing that it was more in line. And so where do these three things leave us as mental health clinicians in our therapy offices? What do we do with this information? Well, I think it's more confirmation that the things that are happening inside of someone are reflected in their physical facial features and other physical characteristics. And it indicates to me that there's not only a long-term relationship between physical health and mental health, but that there are real-time responses we can start to discern in our offices, which will help us determine how our interventions are being responded to in that session. And I think this is really important for us to consider how to do this and how to gain skills in being able to observe facial features, in this case, the eye behaviors of our patients, so that we can really start to understand which of our interventions are the most helpful to them and how we can increase their effectiveness. Thanks for joining. I look forward to sharing more research with you soon. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.